Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much. And I too, Regina, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop, Clinical Trials, How They Transform the Treatment of Cancer. And it's a very important program and one that really, I'd like you to really realize how important this is, and you'll learn this as the program goes on. Today's program is supported by Bristol Myers Squibb, Vaxcell Smith Kline, and an educational grant from Janssen Biotech Inc., administered by Janssen Scientific Affairs LLC, and I really want to thank them for their support of today's program. Now, we have many people on the program today. There's over 203 people on the program today. You come from all of the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, Iraq, Mauritius, Nigeria, Spain, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well. And it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend the next hour with us. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Michael Wong. Dr. Wong is professor in medical oncology, melanoma, and cutaneous malignancies, executive director, integration, and program development, Cancer Network, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Wong will be addressing an overview of clinical trials and why they are important in the context of COVID, Omicron, and seasonal flu, understanding your treatment options, including clinical trials, concerns about participating in clinical trials, what happens in a clinical trial, and types of clinical trials. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Wong.
Thank you, Dr. Messner. It's a tremendous honor and privilege to be here, to spend time with our audience, and to be on a panel with my esteemed fellow panelists, Ms. Kapoor Hinson and Dr. Stuart Fleischman. Amongst us all, there's a tremendous amount of experience in clinical trials, so I think it's going to be a great program. I want to start with the takeaway line, and I want to start by just stating up front that the most important person, the boss of the clinical trial is you, the patient. You actually have the power to say yes or no at any time during the trial. I'm going to start and end with this. You are empowered to participate in the trial, and you are empowered to ask questions about the trial, and you are empowered to just say, you know, not for me, and move on. I'm going to start with that because people have the conception that somehow trials are things that are there and are controlled by the people running the trials. And I'm going to flesh that out a bit, and you'll soon see that that it's really much more of a partnership. So what is a clinical trial? It is a structure in which we are able to do new things, to bring out new technology, to try out new procedures, which may deviate from the current standard of care, and bring this forward to our patients. We cannot just willy-nilly start doing new things or using new drugs, because at the end of the day, we never quite know if we've done well or not well, if we've done benefit or harm, or if in the future this is something we should open up to all patients. So it's a structured format. And there are many types of clinical trials, and I think the best way to understand it is that there are some trials which have to do with therapy and some which are not. And examples of trials that are not having to do with therapy are quality of life types of clinical trials. Dr. Fleischman will say more about that. There are trials in which we're collecting data, in which we hope to understand, for example, rare diseases, and we're collecting data on you. We have to do it in a structured format. We ask you your permission to do it. There are those in which you don't even see anything because it has to do with your blood or your tissue or your test results or images, because we're using them to study a question. And so those are examples of non-therapeutic trials. There are therapeutic trials, which you're more familiar with and gets a lot more press, in which we're using new medicines or new combinations of medicines in a variety of diseases. I happen to be in the oncology arena, and I cannot overemphasize how important it is to be a participant in trial and for us to do trials, because I just came back from the American Society for Clinical Oncology meeting in Chicago. It's an annual meeting with tens of thousands of oncologists, and it's like a trial fest. Everyone's talking about their trials, and why is that important? That's how we move the field forward. By doing this in a structured format, we understand how to use information. Imagine a clinical trial, for example, that I'm participating in, which is open in 40 centers around the world. Imagine if 40 doctors did it 40 different ways and it was different every time we saw a patient. We could not make heads or tails of that. So a trial is a very formal structure with a protocol. And this protocol is shared in the form of a consent form with patients. And Ms. Kapoor Hinson, who follows me, will go into this in more detail to speak about what exactly these documents are. But they are documents that explain, especially the consent form, for example, that explain to you, the patient, what we're doing, why we're doing it, how we're doing it, potential upside, potential downside, what's in it for you, and most importantly, contact information with the people who are running the trial and with the principal investigator. Every trial has someone who's running it. It's a therapeutic trial. Most of the time, it's an oncologist or a physician. If it's the other trials I talked about, it need not be a physician, but it has to be an expert in that area. And so you can see already that this is a transparent type of process. And the consent form also puts forth that after reading this, you agree to do this. But again, remember who's the boss, and I'll come back to that. So it's a structured format that enables us to bring forth new things. So when you read about new drugs that come forward, they are almost certainly a consequence of doing clinical trials in which rigorous statistical analysis are done. These are reviewed at multiple levels. These are presented in front of an audience. For example, at the meeting I just came back from, tens of thousands of people potentially look at it. Is it published? And our own regulatory agency, the Food and Drug Agency, the FDA, actually can certify the data, and then it becomes approved in the indication to which a trial was done in. So therefore, that's how we move the field forward. And the central part of that is you, the patient, right? We look at quality of life things. Is this particular strategy or treatment or whatever better than this one over here? From the point of view of quality of life, and there are rigorous measures of that. And that's an example of a non-therapeutic clinical trials. There are some which are in between. We, for example, a diet trial, which we're changing people's diet in a very systematic way and then trying to understand whether that's helpful to that particular disease state. An example of that would be diet trials for cholesterol and for heart attacks or stroke or in oncology, we're doing diet trials to see if diet influences response to immunotherapy, for example. That's an example of not quite a therapeutic trial, not quite a non-therapeutic trial, sort of in between. So there are many variety of this. Again, the patient is the center of that. A few words about COVID and what's happened during COVID. One of the revolutionary things I say that happened during COVID is that it was difficult for people to freely interact with each other, to come into clinic, to have face-to-face meetings. And therefore, many of us in these academic centers that do clinical trials have really built up a lot of procedures and, I say, muscle, procedural muscle in interacting with patients remotely, electronically. For example, we now have remote consent signing, which you don't have to come in. We are now have procedures and processes in which we can have patients do things by virtual meetings, which were not possible before because we just simply either didn't think of doing it that way, which is one thing, or we didn't have the electronic means and software and apps on both sides of the fence, the physician side, the provider side, and the patient side. We now have that. So these are things which are important and are now new muscles that we have. So I want to just sort of emphasize that at the heart of this is you, the patient. You are spending your time, your energy, and your resources to participate in this trial. We acknowledge that, and without which none of this is possible. It is important to realize, as I close, that you have the right as a patient to really understand what's going on. You have the right to ask questions, and you have the right to say no or yes. We will look after you no matter what you say. But in order for us to try to bring forth some of the best things that we have or new drugs and new procedures which we believe are better, we cannot just do it willy-nilly. We have to do it in a structured way, and for that we used a trial structure. Some patients are worried that they're quote-unquote guinea pigs, that they're going to be on placebos and so on and so forth. That is something to address with the person running trials. In general, placebo trials are not very common, but be aware that ethically, we have to offer that person in front of us the same treatment they would have gotten had they not gone on a trial. And sometimes the standard of care is to observe and do nothing. We believe that we've done enough and we stop here. If we want to do more, then sometimes that has to be done in the context of a trial. That may be a situation in which we may have a placebo arm, but they are not common. And please ask that specific question if that worries you. That's something patients always ask me. So let me end with this. Trials is a mechanism to bring forth in a systematic way new therapies, new treatments. At the core of this is the patient, you. And I will end with what I said in the beginning. You are the boss. You have the power to say yes or no, and I encourage you to be empowered to ask questions, to participate in trials, because it sometimes offers the opportunity to bring the best that we have forward to you, and you have the right to, at any time, to say yes and to say no. I'll end there and cede the floor to my colleagues, Ms. Kapoor Hinson and Dr. Fleischman. And I thank you for your time and attention.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wong. That was an outstanding presentation, and you actually set the stage for today's program. And I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Ms. Nina Kapoor-Hinson. She's supportive care nurse practitioner, advanced practice provider manager, supportive care, geriatric oncology, and integrative medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And Ms. Kapoor-Hinson will be addressing the meaning of informed consent, benefits and risks of participation, how and where clinical trials are conducted, and how to participate in clinical trials. It's really my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Kapoor-Hinson.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner, and Dr. Wong for all that wonderful information and for the opportunity to speak today. And thank you to all of you for listening. It is really my great pleasure to speak with you today. So I'm going to start off today by just talking about the benefits and risks of participation in a clinical trial. So some of the things that you can expect to benefit from if you participate in a clinical trial, you may have the chance to help scientists better understand your disease or condition and to help them advance treatments and or find ways to prevent the condition in the future. You may feel like you're playing a more active role in your health. You may learn more about your disease. You may be able to get information about various resources that you were not privy to before. And some or more than some of our cancer patients participate in clinical trials because they really hope to gain access to a potential new treatment for a disease before it's widely available. So these are some of the reasons that people may participate in a clinical trial or choose to participate. Some of the risks associated with a clinical trial include that it may involve, you know, testing that may present some risk. For example, some physical tests may increase the chance of falling, or x-rays or CAT scans may expose patients to, you know, some amount of radiation. Participating in studies could also create some inconvenience. For example, you may be required to have additional medical appointments, longer medical appointments, more procedures, complex medication instructions, and potentially even hospital stays. For those receiving the experimental treatment, it could possibly come with some uncomfortable side effects, which could range from mild to serious. And the experimental treatment might not work, or it might not be better than the standard of care treatment, because really the goal of the trial is to understand, is this going to be the same or superior to what is currently standard of care, which is the treatment that is based in the best current evidence that we have for the condition. And for trials testing a new treatment, such as, you know, a new medication or device, like Dr. Wong, you know, stated, you may or may not end up being part of the group that gets the experimental treatment. You may instead be in the standard of care treatment group, or if there is no standard of care, or if observation is the standard of care, you may be in the observation or placebo group. Informed consent is provided prior to participation in a clinical trial so that participants can decide if the risks are worth the benefit for them. So what is informed consent and why is it important? For some context, I'll briefly share the history of the Tuskegee experiments conducted in the United States from the 1930s to the 1970s. In the 1930s, Black men were enrolled in a clinical trial to observe the natural course of untreated syphilis, which at the time was incurable. When syphilis is untreated, it can cause serious issues like permanent organ damage, paralysis, blindness, severe mental illness, and even death. In 1947, penicillin became widely available for the treatment of syphilis, but those participating in the study were not made aware of it or offered treatment for the remaining 25 years of the study. The men in the study did not know they were putting their lives at risk by participating in it. They weren't receiving treatment for their disease, and they were not made aware that they may be spreading syphilis to their partners. It wasn't until a whistleblower leaked their concerns to the Associated Press in 1972 that the study was stopped. Ethical and safe research standards have been an area of federal and presidential interest since then, with the development of many organizations and task forces since 1974 dedicated to this topic alone. Valid informed consent for research must include three major elements: disclosure of information, competency of the patient or surrogate to make the decision, and voluntary nature of the decision. So it has to be your choice. As Dr. Wong said, you are the boss. U.S. federal regulations require a full and detailed explanation of the study and its potential risks prior to enrolling a participant. As defined by the National Institute of Health, informed consent is a process in which patients are given important information, including possible risks and benefits, about a clinical trial in the same manner that they would be provided with this information prior to any other medical procedure or treatment. The goal of providing this information is to help patients decide if they want to be treated, tested, or take part in the trial. If new information arises during the course of the trial that may affect a patient's decision to continue, that information must also be provided to participants. The process of obtaining informed consent should include describing the proposed intervention, emphasizing the patient's role in decision-making, discussing alternatives to the proposed intervention, discussing the risks of the proposed intervention, and eliciting the patient's preference. Informed consent will also tell potential participants what their personal or medical information is being used for, how it can be shared, and how their privacy will be protected prior to consenting. All risks associated with the trial intervention must be discussed. This includes general risks specific to the intervention being studied in the trial, as well as the risks of no treatment and alternatives to treatment. Many consent forms may also express that there are no guarantees that the proposed intervention will provide a cure to the problem that is being addressed. Informed consent is mandatory for all clinical trials involving human beings. The consent process must respect the patient's ability to make decisions and adhere to individual hospital rules for clinical studies. Adherence to ethical standards in study design and execution is monitored by a hospital's institutional review board, also known as the IRB. Clinical trials must be approved by the IRB prior to recruiting patients. So how and where are clinical trials conducted, and how can you participate? Clinical trials are conducted nationally and internationally by various institutions like hospitals, universities, federal agencies, etc. They may be supported by publicly funded organizations like the National Institute of Health or private entities like drug companies. Trials have various designs and criteria for eligibility. Having the particular cancer that the trial is studying does not automatically make you eligible for participation, and participation in a trial does not mean that you will definitely get the experimental intervention. When possible, trials have an experimental participant group, which is compared to a participant group receiving standard of care or placebo, as previously discussed. And again, standard of care treatments are the treatments with the best current evidence to treat a specific condition. And placebos, just to reiterate, look like the drug or treatment being tested, but is not intended to change anything in your body. If you're interested in learning about available clinical trials and your eligibility to participate, you should talk with your oncologist. Your oncologist can speak with you about various clinical trials within and external to your treating institution and help you to navigate logistical questions about how you may get more information. ClinicalTrials.gov is an excellent resource to see what clinical trials are available. It is a comprehensive registry and results database of publicly and privately funded clinical studies conducted around the world. You can search in many ways, including by entering the disease or condition, and you can filter to see if a trial is open and actively recruiting patients. Each study record includes a summary of the study protocol, and this resource is provided by the U.S. National Library of Medicine. To participate in a clinical trial outside of your treating institution, you may be required to travel to a participating site or institution. So I'll end there and turn back over to Dr. Messner for the rest of the program. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Kapoor Hinson. That was an outstanding presentation, and I have to say, just a wonderful, wonderful presentation. And I just want to thank you so much. I know there'll be questions for you during the Q&A. I'm going to bring Dr. Wong back on to address topics for Dr. Fleischman. Dr. Wong will be addressing, and he was our first speaker, specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trial participation, quality of life concerns, guidelines to prepare for telehealth, telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions and discussion of open notes, and accessing resources for clinical trials. So it's my pleasure now to bring Dr. Wong back to discuss these topics.
Great. Thank you very much. And let me start with the last question first, because I think that segues beautifully with what Ms. Kapoor Hinson said, which is, you know, you're a patient, you have a certain condition, and you're interested in what's new out there and to look at clinical trials. And I tell folks that there are a couple of places to look, and you really want to look at places that have high-quality information. So one of the websites, very well-curated and important in the field is clinicaltrials.gov, G-O-V, .gov, clinicaltrials.gov. Why is that important? It's a site that is administered by the National Institute of Health. It is governmentally based, so therefore they're not selling you something. That's very important. There are no ads on it, for example. And as a function of our responsibility, many of the large cancer centers in this country are designated as NCI, National Cancer Institute designated cancer centers. In order to get that designation, there's a long process that shows that you have both the personnel, the leadership, the structure to run trials. That includes oversight, ethics, overview, so on and so forth. And if you have all these things, and it's a process that is renewed. It's not just given once and you have it all the time. It's regularly reviewed. It's a very serious business amongst us. And it is a moniker of quality. Many cancer centers in this country aspire to this designation. And I'm telling you this because as a responsibility of being an NCI designated cancer center, we have to accession our trials onto clinicaltrials.gov. That's an example.
And Dr. Wong, I'm sorry to interrupt, but Dr. Fleischman is back now. I want to thank you for filling in for him. And
yeah.
We're going to bring Dr. Fleischman back on. And thank you
thanks.
So much, Dr. Wong. So thanks. Thank you. It's my pleasure now to introduce Dr. Stuart Fleischman, former founding director, Cancer Support Services, Continuing Cancer Centers of New York, now part of the Mount Sinai Health System, and author, researcher in oncology. And Dr. Fleischman will be addressing specific questions to ask your healthcare team about clinical trial participation, quality of life concerns, guidelines for preparing for telehealth telemedicine appointments, including technology, prepared list of questions, and discussion of open notes. Dr. Wong has already addressed accessing resources for clinical trials. So I'm going to just leave this now to Dr. Fleischman. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Fleischman.
Thank you, Dr. Messner and Dr. Wong and Ms. Kapoor and all of you who have taken the time to sign into this call. Dr. Wong gave a good overview of what trials actually are and what they're supposed to do, and a little bit about the myths about what trials aren't. And Ms. Kapoor really explained very well about the importance of consent in trials. I'm going to add some information onto that. In addition to trials, testing a new medication or a new device or a new schedule for a proven drug or even for radiation, trials can look at many other aspects that are very important during cancer to both providers and patients and families. So there are trials that look at different types of nutrition in cancer to make sure that they help keep lean body weight on, to make sure that there is no interference between the multimodal treatments between surgery, chemotherapy, radiation therapy, immunotherapy, and any foods or nutrients that we need to have. There are trials that look at the amount of activity or exercise, which is really important in, again, keeping proper lean body mass, which is an ideal condition during cancer treatment. Some of them are questionnaires that look at quality of life, how much has the cancer or the treatment either interfered or helped with your quality of life. There are other trials that look if you're on an oral chemotherapy or oral immunotherapy, how adherent you've been, that you've taken all the doses, that you've taken them on time. And a variety of trials just look at how the cancer and cancer treatment and being ill has affected your life from a number of points of view. We'd like to say 360 degrees from how you're doing physically, how you're doing psychologically, how it's affected your social circumstances, interaction with other people, and practical things like transportation or the cost of being on cancer treatment. So trials, in addition to the things that we normally think of testing medications or devices, actually can do a lot more. Those trials, once they're approved by the Institutional Review Board, which is a review board in your cancer center or contracted to your cancer center, those are listed on the resources that Dr. Wang just addressed. So either it's through the National Cancer Institute, 1-800-FOR-CANCER, clinicaltrials.gov, American Cancer Society can help you sort out if there are trials in your area or which trials may be helpful for you to ask about and inquire about. There are a lot of people to help out. For people who aren't in the field, it's really hard just to go online and look at the names and the information about the trials because it's rather complicated, but there are lots of resources to help along. You're not doing this on your own. That's important to keep in mind. Dr. Wang also described very well that since the COVID-19 pandemic, we're doing a lot more of the trial work, be it the consent that Dr. Kapoor discussed or interim checkups on devices without having to visit the cancer center. And it's important to just keep in mind how these visits can go best. You need to know in advance what kind of interaction this will be, if it'll be on a regular telephone, if it'll be online, if you can use your computer or a tablet or your phone, if indeed you have only one of those devices, how it's set up. Do you call in? Does somebody call you? And usually if it's the first in a series of these telehealth or remote visits, somebody from the provider's office will be contacting you in advance, and they may even do a dry run just to make sure that everything connects properly. It's also a very good idea to have a list of questions that you have written down, because in the excitement of the moment and the connection and with the device and the provider, it's easy to forget a few things, so have these down. That can be you can be helped by a friend or family member who can act as a scribe, who can write stuff down for you, write the responses down for you. And one of the unintended advantages of the remote telehealth visits is that you can involve anybody who you want, anyone in your circle that you trust or you know has the expertise to be helpful to you, whether they're in the same city, in the same country, excuse me, or even in another country, and they would be able to sign on with you once you gave them permission, as long as they have an internet connection. So it's very important to have the device charged, have a place to speak, have a list of questions, and to understand in advance how you will be connected or how you are to connect to the call or to the application to be able to visit with the provider for either consent or an interim, how are you doing the visit for the trial. One more thing I wanted to bring up is that many of our larger cancer centers and some of the medium-sized ones now have all of their charting electronically. And that gives you access to your provider's notes. And it also gives you access to results of lab tests, blood tests, tests of your stool, tests of your urine, imaging studies, X-ray reports, MRI reports, CAT scan reports, PET scan reports, or even pathology reports. These can be extraordinarily confusing to someone who really isn't dealing in cancer all the time. In fact, especially when it comes to the blood results, urine results, there may be a list on the side of what a normal result of the test would be. And during treatment, some of those things are expected to be abnormal. So it's very hard to interpret this unless you really have a good working knowledge of exactly what's going on from a physiologic point of view. So you will often get access to this before your provider's office had the opportunity to call you. If you read them in advance, please be careful not to jump to any conclusions, not to think something is terribly wrong when it shouldn't be, because having an abnormal test may actually be what is expected and very important for your health. So reserve any reactions. Make an appointment to speak with someone in your provider's office. It may not be the physician him or herself. It may be an advanced practice nurse or an oncology nurse or a physician's assistant. There will be someone who will be able to help you interpret the information that you now have immediate access to. So there's no misunderstanding, and you're able to ask questions and really confirm that everything is going along the way it should. So I believe we'll have a lot of questions today, and I will hand the call over to Dr. Messner. Thank you, everybody.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Fleischman. That was an excellent presentation, and I think that there will definitely be questions for you during the Q&A, so thank you. And actually for all of our speakers during the Q&A. I'm just going to say a few words about Cancer Care Services. I am Dr. Carolyn Messner. I'm Senior Director of Education and Training with Cancer Care. I'm going to talk about Cancer Care's few programs and services, and I'm going to give you information about how to contact Cancer Care. And also, any information that we gave out during the call, like a website or a resource for you, we will, in your SurveyMonkey evaluation that you'll get from us within a couple of days, that SurveyMonkey will include all the resources we mentioned during the program, in addition to your completing the evaluation as well, but it also includes resources. So take a close look at the evaluation when you get it, because there will be resources that you'll want to make note of. So Cancer Care is an organization that's been around since 1944, and it provides free programs and services to people living with cancer. Many people contact Cancer Care in the United States on our Hope Line, 800-813-4673. And they often, the person who picks up the phone is an oncology social worker. They usually identify what their problem is. And then after they do that, and the social worker assists them with that, the social worker goes over all of the programs we offer. So I'm going to just do that quickly with you. First of all, we do offer support. We also do offer practical, financial, and co-payment assistance. We also offer online support groups, and the online support groups are for people of all ages, all types of cancer, from both young adults to older adults to caregivers, and also different types of all the different types of cancer. So there's usually a support group, an online support group for everyone on the call. We also, for those of you who prefer to visit our website, www.cancercare.org. You'll be able to see even a greater listing of all the services that we offer. And we also, of course, offer publications and, of course, these educational workshops, of which we offer many. So those are programs that we have quite a few. And actually, in June, we have quite a few programs. So if you haven't already looked at them or signed up for them, they're there for you. And now we're going to move on to the questions and answers. And I'm going to ask Regina to explain to all of you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we'll take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So this is a question for Ms. Kapoor Hinson. Informed consent. How does the Cancer Center clinical trial staff ensure that patients understand the risks, benefits, and side effects related to the clinical trial?
Sure. So that's a great question. Thank you. So the team, the consent that is developed is developed to, you know, with the patient in mind. The consent is generally written in language that would be understood by all different levels of education. It is meant to be very clear and simple and straightforward, and there are often research assistants or people who are trained in delivering the consent information in a way that is both understandable, and they're there to answer any questions that you may have as well. So, and there's a lot of work that goes into developing the consent and ensuring that resources are available to answer any questions that arise from reviewing the consent after the consent is reviewed.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And a question for Dr. Wong. What makes a clinical trial superior to a typical treatment that has already been around and has proven success?
Again, great question. It's a question of progress. As you know, new drugs and new ideas come along all the time. We are in the golden age of molecular biology, where we begin to understand the genes and the proteins found in disease states, not just cancer, but in a multitude of disease states. And now we have an incredibly robust scientific complex, both with pharma, small biotechs, academic centers, which are able to target these things. It is about progress. And so as we have new ideas and new strategies move forward, clinical trial is a structured way of being able to bring these to patients. Oftentimes, when we do a clinical trial, for example, a phase 3 randomized control comparative trial, there's enough information from phase 1 trials, which are early stages and which all cancers are treated with a new medication, to a phase 2 trial, which is using a medication in a specific disease, for instance, breast cancer, for instance, Alzheimer's. It's a specifically used in that specific situation. And then based on that, if there's promise, then you move to a phase 3 trial where there's a standard of care, which has been the tried, the true, the one that we've been using and have a lot of confidence in, and then the new one. And so, and oftentimes people are randomized by flip of electronic dice as to which one you're in, because we as people who put the trial together believe that the new way of doing it is at least as good as. And I think Ms. Kapoor Hinton actually pointed out the structure of how we try to make sure that things are as it should be. On a clinical trial, you are followed on a regular basis, on a clock. The kind of tests that we do are regimented. You don't have a choice. You do the following things. And they are decided upon because we want to make sure that we cover our bases. We'll look for both benefit, and we look for situations in which we're discovering new side effects. You remember when you ever see an ad on television about a new drug, and at the end somebody comes on and tells you about all the potential side effects, and they talk really, really quickly, and it flies to the screen. Those information oftentimes comes from clinical trials in which we are documenting carefully and succinctly and accurately every single thing that happens on a trial. So you're closely watched on that. So it is a way to bring forth what we believe is the latest, the greatest, the newest to patients, and that ultimately may replace what we believe today is the best standard of care. And that's how medicine ramps forward, by these carefully done studies in which patients are watched carefully, both for benefit and for toxicity on new strategies.
Excellent. Thank you. Thanks. And for Dr. Fleischman, can you explain to me what the term double blind means in a clinical trial? Is it better? Is it a better way of conducting clinical trials than single blind?
So double blind means that the patient doesn't know which treatment that they're getting, and the staff, the physician and the research staff and the nurses and everybody else involved with the care doesn't know what you're getting. If there are two drugs that are being tested one against the other, even the pharmacist who dispenses it may not know, because it is prepackaged by the company who's manufacturing the medication, and it's it's packaged as study drugs. So you're getting the right drug for the right study, but even the pharmacist may not know what you're getting. If there's any sort of worry that there's some untoward reaction, obviously that through the proper, you know, the proper steps can you find out what it is, but no one knows. And that's really the best approach, because when no one knows if you're getting one of two drugs, you can't assume that, well, my pain isn't as bad because it's the active drug. It's the cleanest type of a study procedure, and it gives you and the study team the best information.
Excellent. Thank you. This is for Dr. Wong. I live in a rural area, but I am curious about clinical trials and would love to be considered for one. Do you know of any resources that provide access assistance for people in rural communities who want to try a clinical trial?
What a great question. And I want to point out that most of the care in this country, at least in the oncology setting, I think the number is 70% plus, is delivered outside of major academic medical centers. There are community networks that do clinical trials, and there are clinical trials that don't necessarily mandate that you go to a major medical center. It depends on your specific situation. So because of that, I would start with your local physician or subspecialist, depending what it is. I happen to be an oncologist, so I say start, if this is an oncology issue, start with your local treating oncologist. He or she may be part of a community network. There are trials that are designed specifically to be carried out in the community network and are designed to be run out there. Secondarily, I'm at a major medical center at MD Anderson, and we actually ask patients, care homes, team, oncologists, and caregivers to actively participate in the care of that. So we may have patients only coming intermittently to the major center. Now, the question is, how do you find these trials? Start with your local network of physicians, because they know the things that are possible. And then earlier on in this program, I talked about using specific websites like clinicaltrial.gov, which I explained is a good place to look because of our obligation for major academic NCI designated cancer centers to accession our trials on that site. If you can look geographically as to which major centers are close to you, and all of us, because we depend on you, the patient, to participate in trials, all of us have forward-facing, web-friendly sites that allow you to click through and to look at the disease sites. It's important to look carefully because we have things called eligibility criteria. For instance, if I'm doing a diet study for cholesterol and you're looking for a trial that has to do with blood pressure, guess what? It's you won't fit into the cholesterol trial. So look at things like eligibility criteria. Many of us have easy to click search boxes that allow you to search that way. And finally, there's nothing stopping you from calling in. All the major medical centers have a place you can click, usually with words like make an appointment or call us or so on and so forth, because the lifeblood of clinical trials is you, the patient. You should never downgrade how important you are to us as we do trials. And so therefore, we try to be as user-friendly as possible. I hope this helps you, but start local, and then in a sort of increasing radius of distance, look at the local regional centers that may be experts in the type of situation that you are interested in.
Excellent. Thank you. And a question for Ms. Nina Kapoor Hinson about informed consent. That you mentioned three things, and this participant is asking if you could repeat them. I think what participant has written is competent to make decisions, voluntary, and what was the third thing? I'll leave it to you to address it.
Let me see. Hold on. So what it should include is describing the proposed intervention, emphasizing the patient's role in decision making, and discussing alternatives to the proposed intervention, including and discussing risks and eliciting patient preference. Is that what you're asking? Or I'm sorry, there was another. So that was one part.
So this person heard competent part. To make decision, voluntary, and what was the third thing? I think you've done
voluntary
a great job.
Voluntary disclosure of information. So it's the main elements of informed consent is disclosure of the information by the medical team or the trial team to the patient or participant, competency of the patient to make the decision or their surrogate to make the decision, and the voluntary nature of the decision. So it's your choice. Of whether or not you want to participate.
That's perfect, thank you. And then this question, so this one is for Dr. Wong. Do trials usually involve daily attendance? For how long? Concern about how to get there and having to stay somewhere? Any assistance given? I am doing this alone and am 76 years old.
Again, great question. So one of the things that you will get when you participate in a trial, I'm specifically thinking of therapeutic trials, treatment trials, but this is true also for quality of life things, for sort of non-therapeutic trials, is that you get a calendar. That's important to you and for me because remember I told you we have to do things on a regimented protocol. I cannot deviate and do things like I please. And so I get a calendar too with your name on it. And it'll say, this patient's going to be here at this time, at this date. So you actually know, and you have the right to ask, and you should ask your clinical trial coordinator or your physician about the study calendar. And sometimes we may have two or even three trials that may fit your particular situation. And you, again, can ask for sort of the impact on your time, energy, and travel, and look at the calendar for each of these studies. They will also have what's involved, the scans, the blood work, so on and so forth. Every intervention that involves you is going to be on that because, again, regimented protocol, and also you have the right to know. Lastly, the question you raised, ask about resources. Some of the clinical trials with rare tumors, so we do have trials in which we're looking at very rare tumors that are, I speak from a point of view of an oncologist, that occur in 1 in 1 million people, for instance. They are rare because there are some molecular things that are important, or there are some tissue characteristics that are important. We're really focused on specific things. Because they're rare, the sponsor, the people who run the trial, understand that these are not patients that would be clustered closely together, and it may be spread across the country. So there may be resources for travel and for staying. I'm not saying this is universal. It's a case-by-case situation, but I'm giving you a very specific case of a rare situation, a patients have rare situations in which we desire to try to help them out. And the only way to do those sort of studies is to really provide resources that help people get from A to B and to stay at places. So please ask. That's the number one thing. And remember, like I said in my part, who's the boss? You are. So, and we, as people who run clinical trials and do studies, we understand and are grateful for your participation in these trials.
Excellent. And I'm going to thank our participants and all the speakers, and I'm going to ask each of you, each of our speakers, to provide a takeaway for our participants, starting with Dr. Wong.
Again, there's a being a broken record, you're the boss. Ask and be proactive. Don't be shy. And remember to understand the how, the why, the when. And much of that is found in the consent form that you're going to get. That's a necessary part of going on trial. And within that consent form are the contact information, the phone numbers, the email address of the person in charge of the trial, and you have the right to ask some questions. And once again, I wish you luck, and be proactive. And you're the boss.
Thank you. And Ms. Kapoor Henson?
Thank you. So I would encourage every single person here who's considering a clinical trial to consider your goals and your values with your cancer treatment and share that with your medical team. Knowing what you want to achieve and what your hopes are with any treatment that you move forward with really help the team to decide what the right treatments are to offer to you and help you and allows them to help you to navigate through that decision-making yourself. So keep your goals and your values for what you want out of your treatment at the forefront of your treatment plan and share that with your clinical team.
Awesome. Thank you. And Dr. Fleischman?
Sure. I think the overarching concept here is communication. Communication about how you're doing physically, psychologically, with your family and friends, all the practical issues that come up during the diagnostic phase of finding out if you have cancer and what type, and during treatment and after, and knowing how best to communicate about how you're doing, if there is a trial that is thought to be helpful to you, knowing how to access that information through all the different mechanisms that we discussed, and to make sure that you communicate about any records or notes or test results that appear on the electronic medical record that you can often access before your provider does.
Excellent. Thank you, Dr. Fleischman. I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank our participants. Although we've done this program before, the questions today were really much more, really quite sophisticated and quite excellent questions, and really and down-to-earth questions as well. So really a combination of all of you together made this a terrific call today. And I want to also say that I know that some of you are still in queue because we couldn't take everyone's question. So I want to recommend that whether you asked a question, whether you have a question yet to ask, or whether you are thinking of a question, I would invite you all to go back to your treating healthcare team because they know you the best and ask your question again of your healthcare team with the information you've learned today. That's really very important to do that. Also, I would not want anyone to leave this program today feeling that you're alone. I want you to know that you're part of the community of support and we're all here to help you. You will be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation at the end of this program. And in that evaluation, it will be a couple of days actually in the end in the evaluation. It's an evaluation of the program, but it also will have all of the resources that were mentioned during the program and then some as well. So be sure to look at those resources because those can be very helpful too. I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a great day.